Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The American labor market over the past year has gone something like this. Big job losses last summer to really huge job losses in January and February, back to plain old big losses last month. And that let the president say this today.
We're losing jobs at less than half the rate we were when I took office.
From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
American Public Media presents the Marketplace Whiteboard, videos unwrapping the basics of the financial crisis. You can watch them anytime at marketplace.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Happy Friday, everybody. It is the 7th of August today. Good to have you with us. Let's start with the baseline economic numbers for the day and then take a minute or two to put them into some kind of context. As the president alluded to this morning, the labor market has come a long way in the past 6 months or so. The July unemployment report that we got today was horrible, 247,000 jobs lost last month, but at the same time, really quite promising. It's light years from the 750,000 jobs we lost back in January. At the same time, the unemployment rate, that is the percentage of the population looking for work, has gone down off a tenth percent to 9.4%. So, what to do? How to interpret an economic report that on the one hand is bad, but on the other is pretty good? Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman walks us through the labor market landscape.
The first thing to keep in mind is that there are two government employment surveys. One finds out from employers how many positions they added or cut last month. That's the jobs number. The other asks individual Americans how many people in their household are out of work and looking for a job. That's the unemployment rate. In July, we lost jobs, yet the unemployment rate went down. Economist Nigel Galt of IHS Global Insight explains.
They might seem at odds, but what actually happened was, although employment was down this month, the number of people in the labor force, the number of people out there actually looking for work, that actually fell more steeply than employment.
Where'd all the extra unemployed people go?
Some people who may have been looking for work for a while, or may have perhaps been hoping that they were going to get a summer job this year, have decided that they're unlikely to find anything, and they've actually stopped looking.
We'll get back to that increasing army of discouraged workers in a second. But first, let's look at those job loss numbers. 250,000 is still pretty dreadful, says Heidi Shierholz of the Economic Policy Institute.
The pain is still deepening in the real economy, but at a slower rate. We are definitely seeing a reduction in the pace of the losses, and that's good news.
Still, Shierholz says we have a long way to go until there are sustained job gains. And to turn unemployment around, it can't be just 25 or 50,000 new jobs a month either, says University of Texas economist James Galbraith.
In normal times, we would need to have 150,000 to 300,000 new jobs each month just to stay even.
That kind of job growth might be a year or more away. In the meantime, discouraged workers will keep trickling back into the labor market. Which means long after economists declare the economy in recovery and long after employers stop cutting jobs and start creating new ones, America's households are still going to be suffering persistently high unemployment. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
There was a great set of news alerts that crossed the wires earlier this week. Monday morning, I'm sitting at my desk, minding my own business, when up pops the news that Bank of America will pay a $33 million fine to settle charges it misled investors, specifically about billions of dollars in bonuses it gave executives at Merrill Lynch. Not 2 minutes later came the news that, oh, by the way, the Securities and Exchange Commission is suing B of A over those bonuses. Clearly, the timing makes it work out that it's pretty obvious that the two sides had worked everything out beforehand. Trouble is, they didn't tell the federal judge in charge of the case. He has put a hold on the deal and set a hearing for Monday morning. It is just the latest development in the controversial B of A purchase of Merrill Lynch late last year. From Washington, Tamara Keith has more.
To Columbia law professor John Coffey, this settlement seems all too clean and convenient.
The SEC wanted to show that they were the tough cop on the block. But unfortunately, they've done this with so little transparency that they've raised more questions than they've answered.
The biggest question? Who was really at fault? Typically, when the SEC settles, they fine individual directors or executives. But in this case, the SEC is only going after the company. Lynn Turner is a former chief accountant at the SEC.
The car's doing the speeding, but there's someone behind the wheel pushing the gas pedal. And that's the same thing here. Bank America obviously violated the security laws, but there had to be someone in the company actually doing it.
Professor Coffey says that's what the judge will try to find out at Monday's hearing.
I think he feels that the court is being misused in being asked to rubber stamp a settlement that doesn't answer any of the obvious questions about what happened and who did what.
Coffey says fining the bank rather than individual executives is also unfair to the shareholders.
You were lied to, and now you're bearing the cost because you were lied to. And that sounds like a double injury.
Another question is where the money will come from to pay the settlement, given all the financial aid B of A has gotten from taxpayers. A Bank of America spokesman told me the company looks forward to answering the judge's questions. Calls to the SEC were not returned. In Washington, I'm Tamara Keith for Marketplace.
Imagine what a deal it would be if you could get a look at an incoming stock trade just before it hits the market. Pretty neat advantage to have, no? Well, it turns out those deals do exist in real life. They're called flash orders, and there is a push on in Washington to ban them. The SEC says it's taking a look at it. But two stock exchanges have beaten regulators to the punch. The NASDAQ and the electronic exchange BATS say they will both stop offering flash orders as of next month. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
Flash orders let members of some electronic stock exchanges see orders to buy or sell stock milliseconds before those orders go out to the public. Joe Ratterman is CEO of BATS Exchange. BATS started offering the service to its member brokerage firms in early June, but Ratterman says the recent controversy over the practice was threatening investor confidence in the markets.
The more we watched the debate circulate up to the public media, rather than in the regulatory structure where it belongs, we felt like we were effectively allowing a disservice to happen to the industry.
Ratterman says BATS may reintroduce flash orders in some form if the SEC doesn't ban the practice. The commission is looking into several aspects of electronic trading that critics say leave some investors at a disadvantage. David Lineweber wrote the book Nerds on Wall Street about electronic markets. He says BATS and NASDAQ are making a smart move.
You look a lot better stopping on your own rather than being told to stop or worse, penalized for doing it.
There may be another reason NASDAQ and BATS dropped flash orders. Justin Schack is with Rosenblatt Securities. He says the two exchanges started offering the service only reluctantly after flash orders helped a competitor called Direct Edge win market share.
And that's, I think, why you saw NASDAQ and BATS pretty quickly give in once there started to be some pressure coming from Washington and from different parts of the industry on this and say, you know what, we're going to get rid of it. And now that puts all the pressure on Direct Edge to handle all of this criticism on its own.
Direct Edge says it plans to keep offering its form of flash orders to preserve the flexibility it gives customers. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Really, not as much enthusiasm on Wall Street as you might have thought given that jobs report. Still, not too shabby, though. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. President Obama will be in Mexico this weekend. He and his Canadian and Mexican counterparts will talk North American politics and economics Sunday and Monday. And yes, I grant you those are pretty broad subject areas. Could mean anything from global warming to Mexican border drug wars to immigration. And there probably will be some disagreements. But something else could wind up being especially tricky for President Obama. Trucks. From the America's Desk at WLRN, Marketplace's Dan Gretsch reports.
Under the trade agreement NAFTA, Mexican trucks are supposed to be allowed to cross into the U.S., but groups like the Teamsters Union have convinced Congress to block Mexican trucks from U.S. highways. Teamsters spokesman Brett Caldwell.
Mexico has not improved their safety standards for their trucks or the requirements for their drivers, and until they do, they should not be driving on American roads.
Mexico retaliated in March by imposing tariffs on 90 U.S. products. The tariffs are designed to ratchet up political pressure on the Obama administration to solve the trucking dispute. Chris Sabatini is with the Council of the Americas, a business trade group. He says the tariffs are hitting American farmers and manufacturers in 40 states.
There's been over $4 million worth of losses. It really has opened up and undercut a lot of the intended free trade provisions of NAFTA.
Right now, cargo that passes from Mexico to the U.S. has to be offloaded, carted across the border, and loaded onto another truck. Clayton Boyce is with the American Trucking Association. He says allowing trucks to smoothly cross the border would save U.S. consumers up to $400 million a year.
What it does is it saves fuel and it saves money by making the border crossings much more efficient.
Sunday will be the sixth meeting between President Obama and Mexican President Felipe Calderon. But the Obama administration says resolving the trucking dispute will have to wait until Congress reconvenes in the fall. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
Both houses of Congress are now officially on recess, which means the healthcare war of words can really get going. It has already started, actually, with the town hall meetings and accompanying protesters the past couple of weeks, which might call a public policy free-for-all over how to spend a couple of trillion dollars. To help us do our weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond, we've got Megan McArdle. She's the editor of the Atlantic Magazine's Business Channel with us. Also, Mike Mandel, chief economist for Business Week magazine. Good to talk to you both again.
Good to be here.
Thanks for having me back.
Michael, what about the mood out there in the country? We've all heard the stories about these protests, and now the president's going to go out. I mean, synthesize that for us and help us figure out how to make sense of it.
Well, I think a lot of people sort of look at this as the government imposing more requirements on them. It just feels more like the heavy hand of government. So even the people who might be benefiting kind of have a negative view of this. You know, people can't wrap their minds around this as a benefit. It feels like a cost to them.
Megan, what do you think about that, the whole mood?
It's tough out there, and in general, I think information is sort of hard to come by for a lot of people, so they're a little confused about what's going on.
Which seems kind of crazy that information on this is hard to come by, right? Because to read and to browse the web and everything, it's just you're flooded with this stuff.
Well, I think that's actually the problem, is that there's a ton of information, but separating the signal from the noise is really difficult. Especially now when they're so worried about other things, they don't really have a huge amount of emotional energy to devote to worrying about whether the healthcare bill is a good idea. And so they're sort of susceptible to whoever's talking points they heard last.
Michael, let me get a little bit specific on this one. We read today in the wires that there's some talk among Democrats that they're going to get rid of this public option, that the Senate is now thinking that they're going to throw that overboard and just get a bill to get it signed. What does it mean if the public option, a government-backed program, winds up not being in this bill?
The main point of these bills is to extend coverage to the vast majority of Americans, whether it's 95% or 97%, doesn't really matter. Having the public option in this round, I don't think matters all that much.
Megan, you've written at some length as to how you're not in favor of this plan. What about the public option? Make a difference or not?
From my perspective, because what I'm really concerned about is innovation and what happens when the government starts having a big incentive to control prices in especially the pharmaceutical and medical device manufacturing businesses. From my perspective, not having a public option is fine, is an improvement. From the perspective of the taxpayer, who may not share my concerns about innovation, it's a problem. Certainly what the Democrats have been promising, whether or not this is in fact the case, is that the public option was going to help them control costs, which is the major issue currently on the table. If you look at Medicare and Medicaid, they're already unsustainable. They've already got the budget on a path to crisis. The public option was supposed to be a way of injecting some political ability to control those cost increases. Once the public option goes by the wayside, all you have is cost increases.
Michael, what about this issue of cost control?
Well, remember, there's been two problems out here. One is who's covered, and the other is cost control. The problem with doing cost control when you have incomplete coverage is that the easiest way to control costs is to throw people out of the system. Think about squeezing a tube of toothpaste. The toothpaste pops out if the cap's not on. If you have everybody in the system, then you can start squeezing and it's more effective. I have to say that with Megan, I'm with her. I sort of worry a lot about innovation. But at this point, I think extending coverage is the right thing to do.
All right, let me try to put a punctuation mark on the discussion of healthcare, at least in this segment of the broadcast for the month of August, until substantive stuff really happens. Megan, is there anything that in the next 5 weeks before Congress really starts tackling this again could really just kill it before it comes to some kind of final discussion point?
The mid-session budget review, which is supposed to come out this month, and I'm going to guess that it's going to show tax revenues being much worse than we expected and costs having gone much higher than expected, which means that the budget deficit is actually going to be higher than the current projections that they're working with, which, given that there's no public plan, given that they don't really have a credible way to claim that they're going to be cutting costs, is going to make it harder to pass this bill come fall.
Michael, last word to you. What could do this bill in?
I think the odds are pretty high that a bill or something like this will pass and that the Obama administration will get pounded for it and that the next round of health care reform will come from the Republicans.
Michael Mandel at Businessweek, Megan McArdle at The Atlantic. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, who really ran those fancy historical houses?
She always talked about all the amount of laundry that they generated. They would wear something once, it would go to the laundry. The bath would be drawn, those towels would go to the laundry.
But first, let's do the numbers. Prospect of fewer pink slips had Wall Street tickled pink today, but I'm bummed. The hopeful news lifted the Dow Industrials 1.25%, 113 points, wrapped up the week at 9,370. The NASDAQ added 1.25%, 27 points, closed at an even 2,000. The S&P 500 climbed back above the 1,000 mark. It grew by 13 points, 1.25%, finished at 1,010. It was the fourth straight positive week for the Dow and the S&P. The blue chip index rose 2.2%. The NASDAQ picked up 1.1%. The S&P 500 advanced 2.3%. For the record, the S&P has now rebounded by almost 50% since March, when it sank to a 12-year low. Bloomberg figures the rally has restored almost $4 trillion in value to the U.S. stock market. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Gather.com, the social network where people can make new friends who share their interests. People talking about today's news at news.gather.com. Miss anything in business news this week? Download our new podcast, After the Bell. Every Friday, Scott Jagow makes sense of the week in business and the economy. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Guadalajara, President Obama wraps up 2 days of talks with the leaders of Mexico and Canada. Immigration, drugs, and energy are on the agenda. Entertainer and maker of breakfast foods, Jimmy Dean, turns 81. And beware, this last one is not so great for the waistline. August 10th is National S'mores Day, so get some exercise by reaching for the marshmallow bag over and over and over. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. You wouldn't know it to plop down in front of your television set, but the major broadcast networks are selling less ad time. Networks and ad buyers have just closed out their annual negotiations over how much commercial time to buy and how much that time will cost. The upfronts, they're called. All indications are that broadcasters will be taking home a good deal less cash for the upcoming fall season than they've gotten used to. Michael Berge is the editor-in-chief of Media Week magazine. Michael, good to have you with us.
It's great to be back, Kai.
I suppose we could have expected some kind of drop in these ad sales, but 22% is quite a bit. Is that kind of in line with what we were thinking?
Well, it is in line with what we were thinking, but there is a reason why the drop is as precipitous as it was. The networks, realizing they weren't going to get the pricing they were looking for in the market, have decided to shift some of their ad time out of the upfront market, and they're going to play in what's known as the scatter market, where they sell quarter by quarter.
In the hopes that a couple of quarters from now, when in theory the economy is better, they'll be able to get more money for that ad time, yes?
That is exactly the hope, and they believe that, you know, since marketers, the advertisers themselves, were holding back because they were expecting pricing to drop even further, the networks hope that the marketers will come back in that scatter market and end up paying a little bit more. I personally am not so sure that's going to work out for the networks, because since so much more ad time or inventory, as we call it, is going to be working in that scatter marketplace, supply and demand tells me that there's no way the pricing is going to go up much higher.
Yeah, and today's unemployment news aside, they are kind of rolling the dice that things actually will be better in 6, 8, 10 months.
I think that's very much a crapshoot, yes.
Can we expect to see the same kind of things for cable networks as opposed to the broadcasters, which is what this upfront season was?
I'm going to answer that yes and no. Yes, because it is a tough marketplace out there, and the challenge for the cable networks is that they have that much more ad time to sell. They have just much more inventory working in the marketplace. But no, because cable is really where a lot of ratings momentum is taking place. We're seeing a lot of new cable premieres that are getting ratings that are network-sized audiences. Mm. So there's a lot of ratings momentum and kind of creative development momentum very much working in cable's favor.
Are the networks now going to get more creative with other ways to make up revenue since they don't have this ad money in hand? I'm thinking product placement here and those kinds of things.
Well, the product placement and what the industry calls branded entertainment is really being baked into the process much, much more during these upfront negotiations. And there's one kind of stellar example here. NBC is going to be rolling out the Jay Leno show in primetime every night this fall. Well, that show lends itself to much more product placement style advertising that it was a little bit more sophisticated for the networks and the advertisers to negotiate. So that's one of the new tools that NBC is hoping will be to its advantage. It remains to be seen whether the ratings hold up for that show. And I think there's some question about the ratings, whether advertisers get the bang for their buck that they're hoping for.
Let me take the perspective, before I let you go, Michael, of the person sitting on the couch in their living room watching these shows. Does this mean anything for them other than, you know, more ads?
Well, it doesn't mean much different for them besides more ads. What works to the consumer's advantage is now more and more homes are equipped with digital video recorders, DVRs, and they now have the ability to skip those ads. I am guilty of it myself.
Oh, ditto, baby.
And what's going to happen out there is the networks, and they're working really furiously at this, the networks have to figure out how they're going to keep viewers around during those commercial breaks when they're otherwise skipping.
Michael Berge, he's the editor-in-chief of Media Week magazine. Michael, thanks a lot.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
In this age of instant entertainment and always-on internet, pity the historic house tour. Yes, there are history buffs out there who will always show up, but family trips to historic sites just aren't as common as they used to be. Over the past several years, some of those house museums have seen the writing on the wall. They've revamped themselves to draw more traffic. There's less emphasis now on the furniture and the grand family that used to live there, more on the folks who really ran the place. Ashley Montite reports.
The Breakers was the Vanderbilt family's opulent summer mansion in Newport, Rhode Island. Visitors used to take guided tours of the 70-room house, marveling at the marble walls, vast chandeliers, and intricate mosaic floors. This spring, the Preservation Society of Newport County introduced an audio tour. It's bursting with anecdotes about the family and the servants. Pat Coleman is featured on the tour. She's the daughter of one of the Vanderbilt's chambermaids.
The sheets had to be changed twice a day. She always talked about all the amount of laundry that they generated. They would wear something once, it would go to the laundry. The bath would be drawn, those towels would go to the laundry.
And each bath was made of marble so thick and cold, a maid had to fill and empty it twice before the bath was warm enough for a Vanderbilt. Outside the Breakers, visitor Frank Schmandl says those behind-the-scenes details were well worth the trip from Pennsylvania.
There's certainly no way I would ever have walked the halls with the Vanderbilts, so to hear the other side was very interesting for me.
And let's face it, most of us would have been on that other side. John Church is architectural historian for the Preservation Society of Newport County. He says visitor numbers are up since the Vanderbilts and their staff began sharing the limelight.
And I think the more culturally relevant we become and remain, we'll hold on at least to healthy visitor numbers.
The National Trust for Historic Preservation says historic homes all over the country want to appeal to today's more socially conscious public. That means balancing crinolines and fine architecture with kitchen stoves and even manacles. Many homes in the South now emphasize the slave experience, so do some in the North. I'm on a tour of Philipsburg Manor, 20 miles up the Hudson from Manhattan. It used to belong to a family of Dutch merchants.
So this is set up as a room of a gentleman and a slave trader. I say that today, how does that sound?
Not very good.
No. No, it doesn't. But at that time, the slave trade was, for most people, just like any other business.
Until 6 years ago, the slaves who ran this former plantation in the 1700s were barely mentioned in the tours. Now, the entire visitor experience is built around seeing how they made this place run, often without supervision from an owner or overseer. Peter Curtis works at the manor's reconstructed mill as a miller and historic interpreter. He focuses on one 18th century slave in particular.
And the slaves were responsible of the mill. Caesar was a responsible member. He was bilingual. Math, we think French and Dutch, and he did know some math, but he was in charge of the building.
Visitor numbers have increased by 8% since Philipsburg Manor started telling the slaves' story. Kate Johnson is curator of Historic Hudson Valley, which owns the site.
On the local and state level, we are completely tied into the African American tourism market, and now we're really poised to take it to the national level.
And there's another benefit. Breathing new life into this area of history has caught the interest of corporate and individual funders. Historic Hudson Valley has received several $1 million since the program kicked off. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
You can take a tour of your own on our website. Pictures from the places Ashley went to visit are online at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering absolute return funds with goals designed to match yours. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today, the latest development in green technology. Sprint and Samsung announced earlier this week they're marketing a cell phone made partly from corn. Apparently, they've made the shell out of a corn-based bioplastic, they call it. $50 plus the standard 2-year contract. It's not quite a smartphone, but close. Texting, a couple of web-based applications, plus some special buttons to get you environmental news. You can get your business news right here. That's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow gained 113 points, 1.25%. The NASDAQ rose 27 points, 1.33%. The S&P 500 added 13 points, also 1.33%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer is J.J. Yore. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, do-it-yourself might be cheaper, but some foods are really better left to the pros.
It was very loose, creamy, and it just was not something anybody really wanted to eat.
Delicious. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We are back here Monday afternoon. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media. The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.